Texas during the summer. I would like to speak about a problem I'm kind of interested since a while and without getting anywhere. Okay, my problem is the following. It's a quite long-standing problem in Banner Space Theory, and let me kind of precise it. To make things easy, I simply assume that I have a Banner space which is separable, infinite dimensional, and reflexive, and I also assume, to make things simpler, that it has a basis. Now I'm asking, does there always exist on any of such an infinite dimensional space, does there always exist an operator which is not simple, a multiple of the identity plus a compact operator? I mean, in other words, it's clear that every finite dimensional operator can be extended to any infinite dimensional space somehow. It's also clear that, of course, the closure of these finite rank operators are the compact, in the case you have the approximation property. And then, secondly, it's also clear that the identity in all its multiples are bounded linear operators. So, in other words, the question asks whether there is always something beyond things which must be in the space of bounded linear operators. I mean, there would be a wide application to such a wide application. For example, in the theory of Banach algebras, I mean, I recently talked to people in Banach algebras who are working on the same problem, but it was kind of interesting to see that they're completely working from a completely different direction on the same problem. It was kind of very revealing. Of course, such an example would be the first example of a Banner space on which each operator has an invariant subspace, a non-trivial invariant subspace, because of the theorem of Lomonosov that whenever an operator commutes with a non-trivial compact, it has to have an invariant subspace. And according to Yoram, he told me last year, it would be also a very interesting example in nonlinear theory of Banner spaces. This would be a prime candidate for a Banner space on which all Lipschitz functions, say in R2, for example, would have a point of differentiability. One of the reasons why this problem got kind of... Yeah, because I want sometimes to write down things. One of the reasons why this problem became, at least to me, kind of attractive is that of the certain spaces which were discovered 10 years ago, the so-called hereditarily indecomposable spaces. I mean, I here don't give the definition, but I give an equivalent definition to the hereditary indecomposable in the sense I need it, and it was proven by Ferenczi. A space is called hereditarily indecomposable if every operator on every infinite dimensional subspace is of the form a multiple of the inclusion plus a strictly singular operator. Where strictly singular means it's not an isomorphism on no infinite dimensional subspace. In a way, if you think of LP and LP space, of course, strictly singular is exactly the same as compact. But unfortunately, strictly singular, about different spaces, you will discover that strictly singular is actually very far away from compact in many cases, and especially in the hereditary, unfortunately, exactly in these spaces Gauss and Murray constructed. So,
I have a question.
Yeah.
You've taken a stronger definition.
Yes, and it's exactly, it was proven by Ferenczi. This is what I just was saying. I'm taking this as definition, although it's not the original definition, but it's equivalent. And so in order to make things shorter. Now, of course, it's kind of clear that these spaces have already allow very few operators on them. So this is why they would, of course, be prime candidates for examples. And Gauss proved that, at least on subspaces, that there are operators on subspaces which are non-trivial, meaning no compact perturbation of multiples. And, well, unfortunately, I must say, George Androulakis and I, we proved that the Gauss-Moré space, which was the first hereditarily decomposable space, is not a counterexample to question one. And we didn't have the courage, but it seems that the idea to construct a non-trivial operator in Gauss-Moré space carries over to other known hereditaries in decomposable spaces, like the spaces constructed by Argiro Stigliani. But as I said, it's a very technical proof, if you saw the paper. And since Gauss-Moré is in a way much simpler than, like, for example, Argiro Stigliani's space, we simply didn't have the courage. Right, George? Where is he? actually, what we exhibited in Gauss-Moré space, that you can find something like an infinite tensor product. We found a sequence of functionals, of normalized functionals, so that if you tensor Xn star with the corresponding basis element of the space, and you sum it up, you get a strictly singular operator, which cannot be compact, of course. And actually, you can put any bounded scalar in front of it, any sequence of bounded scalars in front of it. So, which means that actually there are a lot of operators in Gauss-Moré. Simply, there are actually, L infinity is a subspace of the bounded linear operators on Gauss-Moré. Okay. Given that the problem to exhibit non-trivial operators in very concrete spaces is so hard and so technical, I more feel that in a way solving my question one is still very far away. We are very far away from the solution to the question one. And therefore, also in the spirit of the definition of hereditary decomposable, I first suggest a like of easier question, at least if you want a positive solution, an easier question which goes more with the spirit of the definition of HI spaces. So, I'm asking, can we at least always find an infinite dimensional subspace on which we can define an operator into the whole space, which is not a compact perturbation of a multiple of the inclusion. Which, if you think a little bit, at least in the reflexive case, it's exactly the same as saying that you have two normalized basic sequences, Xn and Yn, so that which are kind of apart from each other, so that one dominates the other, which means nothing else. If you have the mapping Xn goes to Yn, this map extends to a linear bounded operator. Okay? And so here, in our previous question, there's no reason to believe that the only counterexamples in the first question must be a HI space. There might be kind of different reasons for a counterexample for the first question. But of course, for question two, for a counterexample, you must look inside the class of HI spaces, clearly. I'm not quite satisfied yet with this this formulation of the question, and I kind of want to propose you today kind of a more structure theoretical conjecture, which would imply if we had a positive answer to that, would imply a positive answer to question two. And let me, before I do that, let me kind of make some remark and some motivation, give some motivation for what I'm doing next. Let's look at the known way to construct HI spaces. There is essentially, in principle, only one way to construct HI spaces, known way to construct HI spaces. The first, you construct a Banach space with an unconditional basis, so far away from HI for the moment, which has the following property, that in each block subspace, you have very different blocks. You have hereditarily very different blocks in the sense that in each block subspace, you find bases, block bases, xn and yn, which are where xn very strongly dominates yn. I'm very vague on this a little bit, but what it means in particular is that the mapping xn to yn is strictly singular, extends to a strictly singular map. So you construct a space which hereditarily has a very different structure, a block basis with very different structure. So contrary to LP, for example, I mean, LP, every block basis is the same, and even Zilson, every block basis, at least after passing to subsequences, are the same, so you construct this. Secondly, you're using these different block bases and their averages to code vectors, and using this code, you add kind of special functionals which completely destroy the unconditionality. So this is the second step. By using this coding coming from these different block bases, you construct special functionals and add them, put them into the unit ball, and then things get distorted, and then you destroy the unconditionality. And this is in every construction of the HI spaces we know today. And in a way, philosophically speaking, what I will want to prove today is if you do something like this, you are very unlikely to get a counterexample to my question two. This is more or less the philosophy of my results. Okay. So, having this motivation in mind, I would like to define simple spaces of class 1. So, I call a Banach space of class 1 if any two normalized block bases, xn and yn, admit subsequences, and I mean you keep the indices, which are equivalent. So this is, for me, class 1 spaces. It is clear that block bases, that LP has this property. Actually, in LP, every block basis are, you don't need to pass the subsequences, and actually it's a property which is characterized LP spaces by a result of Zipin. Actually, a non-trivial fact... Without subsequences. Yeah, all block bases are isometrically equivalent, and this characterizes LP. Now, it's a non-trivial fact proven by Kazatsa, Johnson, and Zafiri that Zielsen space is also a space of class 1. Although, for example, the unit vector basis is not equivalent to all of its subsequences, if you pass through these Ackermann sequences, for example. But if you take any two block bases, you can pass to subsequence so that they become equivalent. This is a fact which was recently generalized by Denny Lung and Tung for all what I call finitely mixed Zielsen spaces, which I will give you later the exact definition, but it's more or less Zielsen spaces which are not really mixed. Okay. Another easy fact which follows, which, okay, I don't have a direct proof for it, but it follows from the Gauss dichotomy result that every Banach space either has an HI subspace or space with unconditional basic sequence. From that, you can easily deduce that every class 1 space has a subspace with unconditional basis. And this is pretty easy. So assume this is not true, then you would have a Banach space X, which is HI and of class 1. So take any block basis. Start with any block basis, which is semi-normalized. Try to find an isomorphy between the even and the odds. So, because it's of class 1, at least for a subsequence, you can find an isomorphy between the even and the odds for n in m. What does this mean? It means that x, because of the HI property, it means that xn plus 1 has to be lambda times x2n for some scalar lambda plus some vector yn, which has the property that, and of course yn cannot be a zero sequence because we assumed that xn is a basis. So that the map x2n goes to yn has to be strictly singular. Right? This follows from the HI property, but of course, and this contradicts the fact that I find a subsequence, so these are equivalent. Right? So this is pretty easy. It follows from the Gauss dichotomy that every class 1 space has to contain an unconditional basic sequence. By the way, I don't have an elementary proof of that fact, other than using the dichotomy. I mean, I don't know maybe it's very easy to see it without any deep result. Okay. Now, the first space, which was not of class 1, was actually a space I constructed in 91 and which then led to the definition of HI spaces. And actually, the space I constructed is not only is it not of class 1, but it's extremely not of class 1. It is what I would call, let me give this definition as, it's a Banach space of class 2, and I mean by that in any block subspace, as I said before, in any block subspace you find further blocks, xn, yn, so that the map assigning xn a yn is bounded linear and strictly singular. So in the space I constructed in 91, you have this, as which I already mentioned before, this extreme different block basis, where the mapping from one into the other is strictly singular. And I call this class of this space of class 1. And now comes, and now I guess my question is, now I think it's obvious what my question now is, and I don't know the answer, and this is actually, for me, it becomes more and more interesting, this question. Does every infinite dimensional Banach space X contain an infinite dimensional subspace which is either of class 1 or of class 2? So this, if you hear this question, this knowing from our experience that in Banach space everything has a counterexample, right? And you might say it's a very daring conjecture, like Nicole said, a daydream. And, okay, at least...
What
did
you say about this?
No, not this, okay.
Different daydream.
No, but okay, let me at least... I mean, I'm really not claiming that this... I'm not conjecture. So I should have said question and not conjecture. But I would have loved to be true. But let me kind of argue a little bit in favor of this question. Okay. If you believe that my question 2 has a positive answer. In other words, that on each Banach space you find an infinite dimensional subspace on which you find a non-trivial operator. If you believe that this question has a positive answer, then Sorry. If you believe in a counterexample of this question, it should be easier to find a counterexample to this conjecture. And it, you could, in some sense, for this question, you could find, and if there's a counterexample to this question, it's very reasonable to assume that there's actually a counterexample among the unconditional spaces. So, to find a counterexample to question one, this could very well be a first step for the construction, because you could start trying to find a counterexample to this a counterexample with unconditional basis to this question, and then use Gauss-Murray or something similar to add new functionals to make it an HI space and hope that the new space will be a counterexample to question two. What you know, let me leave it this.
There is no formal connection right now. You don't know of a formal connection between this question and the previous question.
Well, of course, a positive answer to this answers the other positively. But and the other and the second argument, I tried to motivate before, that the only known way to construct HI spaces is to construct first a space of class 2. This is the only formal, the connection. Let me put it this way. The Gauss-Murray method needs a space of class 2 to begin with for the coding. And then, so this is the formal connection. This was my motivation. So this is if you believe that question 2 has a positive answer, then there should be a very deep structural theoretical reason for the fact that question 2 has a positive answer. And by experience, we know that positive answer in infinite dimensional theory always come in form of dichotomies. It seems that there is like a concentration phenomena going on, an infinite dimensional concentration phenomena, that if either something is true or something completely different is true. And it could be very well that if you think about what if a space is not of class 1 or doesn't have a class 1 subspace, the definition I gave for class 2 is a good candidate for the opposite, for the alternative in a dichotomy result. Okay, let me now tell you, after presenting this, a little bit about some results I have in this direction. Essentially, my results give positive answers to the conjecture in cases of spaces where you're close to little L1. Why this is true, and why what I would need to make these results also to be true in other cases, I will tell you at the end of my talk. Now, the first type of result, actually this was a result I came up with looking at Gauss-Murray space and convexification of this space by my first question was what condition do we have to assume on spreading models in order to get a class 2 spaces? So, this is the first result says the following. We assume we have two normalized block bases, Xn and Yn, which have spreading models, En and Fn, which are very far apart from each other. Namely, they have this property that if you compute the norm of a linear combination of the Fi's, you can find an upper estimate of the form max over all n delta n, max over n coordinates of this norm restricted to this. So if you have this strong domination, this happens, for example, in Gauss-Murray space, then there are subsequences, x and y n, so that the mapping... should decrease to zero. Yeah, no, sorry. Oh, it's a minus delta. Yeah, it's decreasing to zero. Sorry. I actually made this mistake. I saw it already. I made this mistake before already. Okay. In such a case, when you have strong domination from one spreading model by another, you can actually deduce that the underlying sequences generate a strictly singular operator. So let me quickly put...
Bounded.
A bounded strictly singular, yeah. A bounded linear and strictly singular operator, yeah. So let me quickly remind you what I mean by spreading model. So you have a sequence xn, let's say basic sequence, and I'm defining what the norm on the spreading model is. So you have such a linear combination. Then you can, by passing to a subsequence, this always exists, so that this iterated limit of the linear combination of the corresponding underlying sequence. So, now, but of course the problem is that there are HI spaces like Aguirre-Stigliani where all the spreading models are the same. All the spreading models are little L1. So it cannot be used. So in order to deal with these kind of spaces, I have to do a little bit more. Before I can go on and present the second result, I have to introduce some notations. For the moment, I'm considering a subset of the finite subsets of the positive integers. And I assume it's always hereditary, meaning if some set A is in script A, every subset of A is in A. And I assume it's compact. You think of the pointwise topology on the characteristical functions. You take for each A, you identify it with the characteristical function, and then you think about the pointwise topology on that. So this gives you the compactness. And in a way, relatively compactness is equivalent with well-foundedness of, you can think of this being a tree. So relatively compact means this is the same as that there is not a strictly increasing sequence in your set, in your script A set. This is exactly the same. That you don't have a strictly increasing sequence in script A. Okay, now having such a set, you can define the Cantor-Bendixson index, mentioned already by Watzlaw before. This is the minimum ordinal, countable ordinal, for which the alpha, countable ordinal alpha, for which the alpha derivative is empty. It should be on the other side, sorry. Okay, what do I mean by alpha derivative? Well, the zero derivative doesn't do anything. Then going from alpha to alpha plus 1, you take the accumulation points of the previous derivative. And for limit ordinals, you take intersections. This is the similar, like in topological space, you can define these derivatives. And, I will not use the Cantor-Bendixson index, but something which was called by Argyros the strong Cantor-Bendixson index. I want to kind of stabilize it on infinite subsets. So I take actually the supremum over all infinite subsets or a subsequence so that I'm restricting it. I want to make it, the best way is to, I want to stabilize it so that I don't. Okay, some small remarks. There's one fact I always hate about the Cantor-Bendixson index, that the index of all sets of at most n elements is n plus 1. I would have defined it differently, but okay. Then, and also, you see, this is as Cantor-Bendixson and you always get successor ordinals. if you start with a set which has, say, a Cantor-Bendix index alpha, how do I get the index being alpha plus 1? Well, I take all the elements in A and add one new element to it, or possibly new element. And, of course, I always have to put the empty set. Okay, then I get one more. How do I get for limit ordinals, I forgot this. Yeah, how do I get the Cantor-Bendix index alpha plus 1? It's not simply by unifying sets which have Cantor-Bendix index alpha n, but I have to unify them, but in a diagonalizing way. So I take an, skipped an, intersect it with the tail, with the subset, with the tail space, and then take the union. So, for example, I mean, the Schreier set is the set of all A, so that the minimum of A is bigger or equal the cardinality of A. This would be a typical set of Cantor-Bendix index omega plus 1. Okay, so having done this, I can define what I mean by mixed zeros and spaces. I give a quite general definition which kind of includes all the known things. Okay, first I make the following definition. Assume that I have a compact and hereditary subset of the finite subsets of N. Now I have and assume further that I have a finite sequence of finite subsets of N. I call this family A admissible if the following is true. First, I mean, these sets should come one after another. Secondly, if I take the minima of all these sets, put them together in a set, it should be in my family. So this I call A admissible. Okay, now let's assume we have a sequence of ANs, of families, and we assume that they are all hereditary and compact, and they are increasing. One is containing the other. And secondly, we have a sequence of numbers theta n which converge to zero. Then we look at the following norm on C00, which satisfies the following implicit equation. Okay. The norm of x is given by, well, it always has to be bigger than the C0 norm, and then I take the supremum over all n, take the supremum over all an admissible collections, ai. This n should be a k, sorry. This is not. And I restrict the norm on these, I restrict the vector on these sets, ei, and compute the norm. And, okay, since now, of course, an admissibility implies an plus 1 admissibility, you see, the families gets bigger and bigger. I multiply it with a smaller and smaller factor. So this is the balance. You see, this gets bigger and bigger with n, but you have a balance factor. So, for example, this in the space I constructed, an was simply the sets of n elements, while theta n was something like 1 over log n. So. And in Argyros Deliani space, the AN are the nth Schreier sets, whatever this is, I don't need them, I will not need them further, but, and the theta N, something like 1 over N. The nth root has to go to 1, right?
Yeah. I must hope that we have to mix zero sandwich Argyros. Long time ago, Argyros and Deliani had some definitions.
Right. This is exactly... Okay. Take AN, the nth Schreier set.
No, I'm not talking about Argyros-Deliani space. I'm talking before Argyros-Deliani space. Oh, okay.
There was a paper with Dale.
We can discuss it.
I know what you mean. Yeah. Which have arbitrarily high Slank index, right? The space where you get any. Okay. Now, okay, so having done this and having introduced complexity of this system of sets, I can now do the following. What I want to do is the following. I have two semi-normalized basic sequences, and I want to measure the closeness. It will be like this, from what I'm defining. If the index is omega 1, they will be isomorphic by passing to a subsequence. But you see, I want to kind of measure I want to have a quantitative measurement of closeness, and so the bigger the ordinal will be, the closer they are. What I'm doing is I'm taking any number C, and I simply define the set of all finite subsets which have the property that on this subset xn and yn are C equivalent. Right? Okay. Now I define gamma of x and yn, the supremum over all are ordinals for which there exists a C smaller than infinity that this set has index higher than alpha. Right? So the bigger the gamma is, the closer are the two basic sequences to each other. Make sense? The higher is the complexity of the sets for which they're closed. Then a very easy proposition, it's very trivial, is that saying actually X is of class 1 if all blocks have closeness omega 1. If the gamma is actually the first uncountable ordinal. Okay. Okay, so now this is a little the problem, and I will tell you what I really would like to do, but what I cannot do, is really look at the Banach space and compare the gamma of any, take like the two block bases with the biggest distance, or with this, right? I mean, this is the thing. Unfortunately, I cannot do this. I cannot get a result. I will point out the problem, and also I will point out what has to be proven in order to be able to do this. The only thing I can do is I can take two block sequences and compare them both to little L1, and then I can get something. If I have two subsequences which have different distance to little L1, but of course I'm doing a detour here. And, of course, I never get an optimal result by this. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm comparing a given sequence with little L1. I take the set of all A's for which xn on A is C equivalent to the corresponding little L1 basis of same cardinality. I compute again. I compute, yeah, this I didn't do before. Fixed ordinal beta, I can call Cxn beta the infimum of all C's, so that this set has index bigger or equal beta. And as before, I call beta of xn simply the gamma of xn with a little L1 basis. To recall what this means, it's simply the supremum of all betas for which this number C of xn of beta is strictly smaller than infinity. Or you can say it differently, it's the supremum of all ordinals beta for which there exists a C, so that this set here has at least index beta. Okay, now I assume the following two things. I have a space X, and okay, this will exactly apply to all the mixed Stielson spaces. Well, to one, the mixed Stielson spaces which are not finitely mixed Stielson. Yeah. So assume that we find a beta knot in smaller than omega 1 and a delta knot bigger than 0, a certain threshold. So that on one hand, we find a sequence whose index is not bigger than beta knot. So in other words, it's kind of far away from little L1, at least on the set of complexity beta naught, you do not get uniform equivalence. Okay? On the other hand, for anything smaller than beta naught, I'm not claiming there is one sequence for which this is not true. I'm only saying that for everything strictly smaller than beta naught, I find a block for which this number is bigger than delta naught. So in other words, for every beta naught, I find at least one block which has the property that on a set of complexity beta, you have uniform equivalence. Okay? So then the conclusion is there exists a block basis Zn and a subsequence Yn prime of Yn so that the mapping Zn goes in Yn prime extends to a linear bounded strictly singular operator. I mean, it looks technical, but let me...
I think you wanted to put C is less than delta
Z. No. I want them to be bigger than... See, I want the equivalence... smaller. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So, first, this shows that at least for the mixed zeros in spaces where the ans have complexity higher than omega plus 1, because there's a space of, I mean, there's the space below. Okay, well, the thing I want to make sure that mix, the space I'm considering has little L1 finitely block represented. But if you take ans of complexity strictly smaller than omega, you get, for example, a space of Lior-Zafiri, which, of course, doesn't have little L1 finitely represented. So I don't want to, I want only to consider spaces which contain little L1 finitely block represented. So this is why I'm making this assumption. So then you have two situations. Either on a subspace, at least, this space you get is equivalent to a finitely mixed zeros in space, which means you only need finitely many ans for the definition of the norm. Then you are exactly in the situation of Denny Lung and Tong, and you have a space of class 1. Or you are not, you cannot do this. You kind of, the ans are all essential for defining the norm on each subspace. Then you have a subspace of class 2, and you can verify my condition of before. And actually, the proof is very similar. I mean, I'm using a lot of facts and lemmas of many people. Of results which have the goal to prove arbitrary distortability of these mixed zeros in spaces. There seems to be, like Joram was saying, between differentiability and distortability, there seems to be a connection. I have kind of the feeling that between being in class 2 and concrete arbitrary distortability, there seems to be a connection. Okay, but this is also very vague. I mean, okay, now, as I said before, the problem of my result is that instead of comparing two block bases directly, I have to take this detour via the little L1 basis, which I lose a lot of mileage. Only in the first, in my result on the spreading models, I didn't need to do that. I could compare them directly. Here, when you are kind of on higher complexity, when you're looking at higher complexity, you need to take the detour over little L1. Let me explain why this is so and what could be done against it. Okay. In both results, in both theorems, I prove something of the following sort, which I already mentioned before. In both results, I can exhibit two block bases, Xn and Yn, satisfying the following type of inequality. If you take a linear combination of Xi's, you have a lower estimate of that form. What does this actually mean? Let me be more precise. Forget the n, for example. Fix the n. You have a lower estimate like this. This means nothing else that a projection is bounded, that the projection on these sets is bounded. And this is exactly the problem. I have to have an argument for the boundedness on the projection on the sets out of my, on the coordinates E. And then I have to exhibit a second sequence which has this, satisfies this inequality. Now, this is exactly the problem that I need to assume boundedness of certain projections. So in other words, I have to assume some kind of partial unconditionality. So, both results use what I call a partial unconditionality results. Okay, what do I mean by this? The question is the following. You have, say, a weakly null sequence, a normalized weakly null sequence. You have a subset of the finite subsets of the integers, and you ask yourself, when can I do the following? When can I find a constant so that I can project on all the coordinates of all the elements of my class A? When do I have like a uniform bounded projection for all these? This is the question. Unfortunately, there are only exact, as far as I know, there are two answers. One is, Ted answered this question, is whenever the index of my set is omega plus 1, what is called like the Schreier unconditionality. This was the result I used for my first theorem on the spreading models. The second instant where you can find such a constant is in an instant which proven by Argyros, Merkourakis, and Tsapalias. And it says the following: if on the set E the xi's are uniform equivalent to little L1 n's, then you also have partial unconditionality. And this is exactly the reason why I had to compare all the block bases to little L1 n's. I had to go this detour. Okay, so these are the two. And by the way, if you ask whether Ted's result could be generalized to higher complexity, already in Gower's Mouret space, this uniform projection constant doesn't exist for sets of complexity omega squared plus 1. So already the next level, it's not true anymore. So on Schreier 2, so this will be on Schreier 2 sets, you cannot project in Gauss-Murray and get a uniform constant. Okay, so, but of course Gauss-Murray has this other good property. You see, Gauss-Murray, although you can project on very little coordinates, it has the advantage that you have these spreading models which are very different from each other. So this is what helps us. So the question is, the next step, it's not the final step, but the next step, what would we need? We would need a result of the following type. And I hope that the understanding... Before I say what we exactly need, we kind of would like to prove a quantitative version of Gower's dichotomy, in some sense, of the following form. Assume that there is a beta, an ordinal beta smaller than omega 1, so that all block bases are distance bigger than beta from each other. In other words, they are similar. At least the bigger gamma is, the similar are the block bases. So for all block bases, they have a strict lower bound beta. Gamma has a strict lower gamma. Okay. So what means, because you probably forgot this as well a couple of slides ago, it means nothing else that if I take this finite subsets of n on which xn and yn are uniformly equivalent, has a index of at least beta. Okay, let's assume this. Now, the question is, does this imply that there exists a block xn and some constant bigger than zero so that the xn's n and a are C complemented, so uniformly complemented in the infinite space? So in other words, what you would like to prove is the closer all the block bases are of a given space, the more you can project, the higher is the complexity of the sets on which you can project. And in a way, okay, so this is the type, and it's true, well, what from TET results, it shows that it's true if the gamma is equal to the smallest countable omega, namely omega. If you want, you can interpret it from the corollary of Gauss dichotomy. You can interpret it in this way, that if gamma is the biggest possible ordinal, namely omega 1, then it's also true, because then you have an unconditional basic sequence and you can project anywhere you want. So, in a way, this question is true in the extreme cases, and you kind of hope that it's true in between, too. Okay, does this solve the whole problem? Yeah, unfortunately not. But at least what it will tell us, if solving this problem, would tell us that little L1 is not such a special case for this problem. You can, I mean, I think I'm finished here. Thank you.
So, what do you think? The answer is positive to your problem?
Okay, I would like to believe that whatever the answer of problem 2 is, it's also the answer of my conjecture. This is the only thing I...
I don't understand what you said.
Well, I think... Well, of course, I hope that every Banach space has a subspace of class 1 and class 2. And I hope also, and I think that this question is equivalent to the question 2. The first question, I think, is very different. The first question, where you only want to avoid non-trivial operators on the whole space, I more and more believe it's completely different from the second question. Of course, a counterexample to the second question would imply a counterexample to the first question. This is, I mean, given. I believe that the first question, although they sound very similar, they are very different. All techniques are different.
Are only the direction of the second question.
Right. Well, in Banach algebra, actually, they have techniques for the first question. I found out. I mean, I haven't studied that very well yet.
Any more questions? Let's thank the speaker.